Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle, and you are listening to the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast online at schwepp.net. Episode 143, Politics and Religion in Late Antiquity, Part 1. Geopolitics, Empire, and Rabbinic Judaism. In this two-part episode, we thought it would be a good idea to pause for a moment and take stock of where we are chronologically. The podcast has arrived near the end of the eventful 3rd century, but there are a lot of loose threads churning around in the Roman world, and indeed in the world of the Romans' primary competitor, the Sasanian Empire, which now really begins to enter the stage of the history of Western esotericism for a number of reasons, which will become clear anon. We've been paying a lot of attention to the narrow elite world of late Platonism, but we know that in the background, on a less elite and narrow basis, major new religious movements like Mithraism, Manichaeism, and Christianity are spreading and interacting. Then there are the Jews. We haven't really checked in with the Jews as such since episode 49. What has been happening with the Jews since the destruction of the temple in 70 CE? How are the Jews dealing with the rise and spread of Christianity and other religious movements, like some of the Gnostic sects we've discussed in the podcast? In coming episodes, we're going to explore the awkward period of Jewish history when the Second Temple period shades off into something new, the Rabbinic period. But in order to do that, it might be good to cover a few basics about, for example, what Rabbinic Judaism is anyway, and when and how it arose, and so forth. Now, this isn't the History of Mainstream Rabbinic Judaism podcast, or really the History of Mainstream Anything podcast, but it behooves us to understand the basic building blocks of the exoteric religions, especially Judaism and Christianity, within which the esoteric currents we are studying grew and evolved. We will also in coming episodes be looking at the rise to imperial power of Christianity, arguably history's most successful offshoot or development of Judaism, with Islam as the close second, of course, to be discussed when we get to the 7th century. Constantine the Great's reign over the Roman Empire started in 306 CE, after all, just a few years after the beginning of the 4th century. And by the end of his reign, Christianity had gone from recently persecuted illegal movement to imperial creed of the empire, smashing temples and taking names. Surely a lot of changes must have been happening between the writing of the New Testament in the 1st century CE and the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in the early 300s, such that what started as a fringe Jewish cult could be instated as the official imperial cult. So some background will be helpful here as well, I feel. And part two of this episode is devoted to the intersection between the Christian and the political in late antique Rome. Of course, the downfall of paganism, so-called, is also a powerful aspect in the imaginary of many modern esoteric religious movements, from neo-pagans of various flavors to all manner of romantic and nationalistic reimaginings of the European past. And it's good to get the historical basics right before we tackle the reimaginings. So we want to look at what really happened with paganism, right? But we also want to contextualize esoteric currents within Christianity itself. In coming episodes, we will discuss a number of crucial late antique Christian texts and movements which lie at the root of many aspects of the esoteric within Christianity. Things like the pseudo-Clementine literature, various apocalypses and testaments, the work of Evagrius of Pontus, and the 4th century so-called Origenism, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries actually, the pseudo-Dionysius, and so forth. Paracanonical material, which is in a sense legitimate Christian stuff, or like the Enoch literature, has always exerted a strong esoteric influence on mainstream Christianity, even while some of it remained beyond the pale of openly accepted doctrinal material. And we're also looking forward to exploring the weirder side of extreme Christian asceticism in late antiquity. We're also going to be covering a number of cool developments in magic, astrology, and occult sciences among both Christians and Jews in our period. And as seasoned listeners will be unsurprised to hear, but as might surprise many a fundamentalist Christian out there, or a very mainstream kind of normie Orthodox Jew, magic and divination have been going on in the Abrahamic faiths for as long as we have records of the Abrahamic faiths. And late antiquity provides us with a very rich dossier of monotheist, addressative practices, astrology, and so forth. So before we get to any of that esoteric stuff, we're going to pull the focus back and reacquaint ourselves with some basics of religion and politics in later antiquity, so as hopefully to be better able to situate the material we've been covering lately in the podcast, as well as the material to come. When we get to the great Emperor Julian, we should be diving back into politics a little bit as well. It's not often that you get an emperor who is also a theurgic, esoteric initiate and who formulates his policies accordingly, after all. And we need to do justice to the man in all aspects of his multifaceted activities. So this episode will also provide some crucial background to the more detailed discussion of Roman internal politics of religion to come. So before we even get to the Jews, Christians, Manichaeans, and Mithraists, let's talk basic geopolitics for a moment. As you know, gentle listener, but as you might appreciate a brief reminder of, I know I can always use a helpful reminder about names and dates and stuff like that. Things have been happening in the Roman Empire's great political rival, the Persian realm, for some time. We call this state the Persian realm in a kind of general and bogus way. What we're actually dealing with is this, in extremely abbreviated form. Going back in time now to the 4th century BCE, Alexander had conquered the Achaemenid Empire, the first sort of Persian Empire, and the Seleucid or Seleucid successor state had then ruled what we call the Near East and Persia, stroke Iran, for several hundred years, right? These are the Greek-speaking Hellenistic kings. The Seleucids had to deal with loads of difficulties, including Jewish revolts, which we covered back in episode 49, and which are still commemorated in the holiday of Hanukkah. But what ultimately proved fatal to the Seleucids was the pressure of two new regional powers, the Parthian or Arsacid state growing in the east, and in the west, the late Roman Republic, busy gobbling up the eastern Mediterranean. The Seleucid Empire was basically chopped in half and absorbed, leaving a Roman Empire abutting the vast Parthian state to the east, and the Parthian state corresponded territorially to the original Achaemenid super empire in rough location, minus the Roman-controlled Near East and, crucially, Egypt, which is Roman. By the middle of the 1st century BCE, the Seleucid state is no more. Okay, the Romans and Parthians then fight a lot for a few centuries. If Roman armies are engaged in suppressing tribal peoples who don't live in cities, it's generally along the Rhine frontier, or in Gaul or Britain or North Africa. But if they're fighting pitched set-piece battles against a trained army with relatively equal numbers to their own, it's always a war on the eastern frontier against the Parthians. Until, that is, the Parthians themselves fall in the year 224 CE, not to the Romans, but to an internal coup led by another Iranian Persianate-speaking group of folks, the Sassanians, the Sassanids, the House of Sasan, who are now going to control more or less the same region as the Parthians, modern-day Iran, Iraq, and some of the Levant, with border territories further east and various client kingdoms on the borders. Armenia is always a big, important client state that the Romans and Sassanians are both trying to control. From the year 224 until their fall to the Arab invasions in a few years, beginning from about 651 CE, 224 CE to 651-ish. Throughout late antiquity in the Near East, in other words, the Sasanians are in charge. Thank you, Parthians. You may go. The Sasanian Empire is now the second major power of late antiquity in the West, only they don't call themselves the Sasanian Empire. They refer to the land that they rule as Iranshar, the land or realm of the Iranians. The Islamic Republic of Iran still carries a form of that name to this day. Now, these guys are important to the history of Western esotericism in a number of ways. First of all, the border between Rome and the Sasanians shifted all the time based on wars fought between the two powers, but it rarely shifted all that much. But it was, anyway, never really a cultural border, only a political one. Thus, Aramaic-speaking Jews existed as a continuum on both sides of the border. And a lot of formative rabbinic culture that we're going to talk about in this episode takes place not in the Roman world, but in the Sasanian, as we shall see. Actually, some of the sages whose words are recorded in the Mishnah and Talmud hailed from the very late Parthian period. Mani, the prophetic founder of Manichaeism, was actually born in the newly Sasanianized empire, as we discussed in our interview with Jason Bedun in episode 123. Manichaeism is a crucial part of the story of Western esotericism, but as a religion, it wasn't exactly Western. If anything, the Manichaean heartlands would end up being Central and East Asia. But only broadly speaking, because the Christians drove them out from the Roman realms after hundreds of years of persecution, a story which will pop up here and there in the episodes to come. The story of what might have been the first true world religion, but which never quite made it. We shall also see that many interesting forms of Christianity, and in particular a crazy flourishing of monastic and ascetic culture, took place more or less right along the border between the two superstates, and really belongs to a Christian Syriac culture which was more or less transnational. Now, another kind of oblique way in which the Sasanians are important for the story of Western esotericism is that while they largely pursued the usual Near Eastern policy of tolerating any religion that didn't mess with state power or tax collection, they did undergo the typically late antique move towards a state religion, that is, Zoroastrianism, and b, a rejection of statue worship and the more iconophilic type of religion that we associate with traditional Mediterranean forms. The Sasanians codified and made official their form of what is nowadays known as Zoroastrianism, a religion based on very ancient traditions, originally oral material. And this, the dating of this gets really tough because the text known as the Avesta, the scriptures of Zoroastrianism, only get written down in very late antiquity, in the Islamicate period. And finding the truly old Avestan portions is something of a puzzle. But anyway, these portions of the Avesta are associated with the mythically ancient sage Zarathustra, whose teachings were already important in the Achaemenid period. That's the first Persian Empire, right? But whose religion, the religion of Zarathustra, now became kind of an imperial creed under the Sasanians. Zoroaster, for it is he, the Greek form of the name Zarathustra, as we have seen in a number of episodes already, had the reputation in the Greco-Roman sphere as an ancient sage, maybe even the most ancient sage, but also as a kind of perennial other. He was associated with the Persian Magi, Magi, in many Greek and Latin sources in some vague way, and hence with the double-edged idea of Magia, Magia, magic. Always frightening, but also always fascinating. Now, Zoroastrianism is famously a dualist religion, positing an ages-long conflict between the good god, Ahura-Mazda, and his evil counterpart, Ahriman, which is being waged in the world and in the hearts and minds of believers, who are meant to be kind of soldiers on the side of the good. Obviously, this dualistic current couldn't help but influence all kinds of thought in its cultural sphere, such that Mani's take on the esoteric Christian teachings he received as a child shows some blatantly dualistic and blatantly Iranian traits, which he probably picked up just from the drinking water in Sasanian Persia. But we might want to cast our net wider and consider the whole, what you might call, dualistic turn of late antique monotheisms. Remember the Middle Platonist Celsus's attacks on Christianity for positing the existence of a devil, which we discussed in episode 99. And you can add to that, think of all the, you know, the evil daimones that have been popping up, even among Platonists like Porphyry, whose commitments to Plotinus's teaching should really make such principles of evil simply not existent. I suspect these phenomena are signs of, well, this cannot be proven, a general trend in later antiquity toward thinking in terms of active agents of good and evil, and this is kind of across the spectrum of Roman religions and even of philosophy. And I feel like this must have had something to do, in part, only in part, with the revival, the Sasanian revival of strongly dualist Zoroastrianism as the state-sanctioned cult of the Sasanian Empire. So that's a bit speculative, and it's I'm always wary of these sort of broad narratives, but at any rate, that is our geopolitical situation in late antiquity. Two empires alternately at war or maintaining uneasy truces, which either side is liable to break if they see an opportunity, but never really achieving that much through their ongoing warfare, and arguably fatally weakening themselves in the process, such that when the Islamic or Arab invasion arrives in the 7th century, the Arabs are able to sweep aside both the Roman and the Sasanian armies with relative ease, as we shall see in episode 200 and subsequent episodes. That's oversimplifying things, and we'll get to what we think really happened when we get to the 7th century. But for now, we should just be aware that when, for example, we talk about late antique Jews, Manichaeans, or Christians, we are often talking about people living in the Sasanian realm, the Roman realm, or a bit of both. So the West, as a concept, especially in late antiquity, is already spreading quite far into, well, the East. Now let us turn to the first Abrahamic group, the ones who started this whole monotheist thing in a certain sense. I refer, of course, to the Jews. We need to discuss the rise and development of rabbinic Judaism. In episode 49, we discussed Second Temple Judaism, which was the period when the Jews really come onto the stage of the nascent West. It's in the Second Temple period that we get some of the key documents of Jewish and Christian esotericism, namely the apocalypse genre generally, as discussed with John Collins in episode 50, and the Enochic material in particular, which we discussed back in episode 51. It's not that the production of apocalypses stopped once the Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70 CE. Far from it. As anyone with a little knowledge of later Christian esoteric writing is well aware, and as we shall also see, Jewish apocalyptic remains a living genre. The next big apocalypse we're going to discuss is the Book of Zerubbabel, which was written sometime in the 7th century. But the roots of the apocalyptic genre lie in the Second Temple period, as do the roots of the idea that God will in some way end the current world order and redo the whole show. There's a reason that this kind of expectation is called apocalyptic, because it appeared initially to us in texts which are known as apocalypses, revelations. Now, Christianity itself is an offshoot of Second Temple Judaism, not only in that it has messianic end times expectations, and a lot of other characteristics we associate with, for example, the kind of Jewish thought found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but also the historical Jesus, whoever he might have been, lived in the last generation or so before the Jewish revolt and the destruction of the temple by the Romans. Now, one of the ex eventu prophecies that we find a lot in the Gospels is that the temple is going to be destroyed. And that actually gives us strong reasons for dating the New Testament text sometime after the year 70 CE, which is when it actually happened. So where are the Jews in the Roman period between the destruction of the temple and, say, the end of the 3rd century where the podcast is now? Well, they're transforming into something which will eventually emerge into the medieval period as what is known as rabbinic Judaism. But first of all, the general political situation. Jews were generally more or less tolerated by the Roman and Sasanian governments as a matter of policy. There was a lot of ill will, what you might call anti-Judaism, afoot in the Roman world, partly because of the three major Jewish revolts against Roman rule, which occurred first from 66 to 70 CE, the so-called Jewish War immortalized by the Romanized turncoat Josephus, then the Kittos War of 115 to 117 CE, which is also sometimes called the Diaspora Uprisings, which is just kind of widespread unrest among Jewish populations in the empire. And lastly, the so-called Bar Kokhba Rebellion of circa 132 to 136 CE. This last revolt, which arose in the Roman province of Judea, was led by one Shimon Bar Kosiba, who either claimed to be the promised Messiah or was considered to be so by at least some of his followers. So this was the parameters are argued about, but it's possibly a kind of outbreak of messianic fervor among certain Jews. Our evidence for what you'd call a developed theory of messianism in Jewry at this time is very patchy. But there is a whole lot of evidence that on the popular and elite levels, a lot of Jews were waiting for a political leader with sort of politico-salvific overtones and a role to play in the drama of the eschaton, the final sort of drama of the earth before God remakes everything. Bar Kokhba is part of that evidence, as are the murmurs of a coming savior found in the Enochic material, as are some little hints in the Qumran documents, and of course, as is pretty much the entire corpus of early Christian texts. This messianism aside, the Romans, in dealing with the Jewish population, basically followed the lead of the earlier Hellenistic kingdoms, which, while perfectly willing to visit savage violence on groups of Jews who they thought had crossed a line, usually a very concrete political line, like demanding independence, generally accorded the Jews the official status of ethnos in Greek, or in Roman terms, religio licita, a recognized legal cultural tradition. Now here's an interesting thing. Normally, if a Roman general had a major victory over a natio, which is the Roman idea of an ethnic group, a sort of linguistic stroke, cultural stroke, religious group, the general would get a title, like Scipio Africanus. This doesn't mean Scipio the African, it means Scipio the guy who slaughtered the Africans to the point where they ceased to be a threat to the Romans. Similarly, we find Roman generals with honorary titles like Germanicus, Gothicus, and so forth. Despite the three fairly major campaigns against various local Jewish rebels, however, we never get a Roman emperor or general known as Eudaios. The Romans chose to frame the victories over these Jewish uprisings not as defeats of the Jews as a people, but simply as local peacekeeping exercises. The reasons for this are surely complex, but must have included the fact that there were maybe 100,000 Jews in major centers like Rome and Alexandria. This is an educated guess, but the figure is something like this, really a lot. And even if you did hate them and think of them as un-Roman and all the rest of it, they did have this reputation for fighting like hell if pushed to it, and on the other hand, for being quite willing to get on with the Roman regime if you didn't push them. So why push them? So the Jews enjoyed what we might call an uneasy toleration with ethnic privileges in the Roman Empire. We'll see a concrete example of this when we get to the question of persecution of Christians. I'm skipping some pretty heavy anti-Jewish violence, which occurred from time to time, but most of which was unofficial. And indeed, we do have many examples of the Jewish communities at Alexandria and elsewhere appealing to the Roman regime for defense against mob actions, as we saw back when we discussed Philo. In coming episodes, we shall see that they were also doing okay in the Sasanian realm most of the time. So that's the general political situation of the Jews, and it's all going to change with the advent of imperial Christianity, but that's for next time. Now, what is rabbinic Judaism? Dig. This is important, and we are going to oversimplify to the max in the following section. So everything in this next section of this episode is going to be crucial for understanding the history of Judaism going forward. The Jews in the Roman realm had had their society pretty thoroughly shattered by the Roman state power. First, their semi-independent Roman client state had been absorbed into the empire, and their temple had been destroyed. And then repeated attempts to regain some form of political independence had been put down in the inimitable Roman style. Reactions to these disasters varied among the survivors. One reaction, arguably, was Christianity, a new form of Judaism, which in due time would simply sever its ties to its parent religion and forge its own path. But another group would not sever these ties. These are the Jews who remained Jews. We're pretty unclear about many of the details of what follows these tumultuous centuries among these Jews in the Roman Empire. But when the dust settles, we see a radically transformed Judaism. It has been transformed by specialist ultra-pious Jews, known to posterity as the Tanaim, the sages, and later the rabbis, the masters, Jewish intellectuals practicing a strict version of the Jewish law and actively engaged in figuring out what that law was in its details, especially in light of the new circumstances. No temple, no temple priesthood, etc., etc. How do you be a Jew in this new situation? Well, the Tanaim and the rabbis are going to figure that out. Some of these sages date to the times before the temple's destruction, but the bulk of the period known as the rabbinic period, which is a time frame used by scholars to refer to basically roughly the end of the Second Temple period until roughly the Arab conquests, a time in which key texts like the Mishnah and the Talmuds are being composed. It's a fairly sloppy category historically, with fuzziness at either end, but the point is what goes in at one end is Second Temple Judaism, and what comes out the other end is recognizably Rabbinic Judaism. Jews who follow the rulings of the Mishnah, the Talmuds, and other texts devoted to recording the sayings and deeds of these sages we mentioned earlier. This is what happens in the rabbinic period. Now, can we say more about who these sages were? What kinds of Jews were the sages of the rabbinic period? As we know from our main sources for Judaism in the first centuries BCE and CE, and these sources are the Qumran, or Dead Sea Scrolls, in the first century BCE, somewhat later the writer Josephus, then the so-called New Testament and other early Christian writings, which are dating to when Christians were a flavor of Jews. And, of course, there's the outlying evidence of Philo of Alexandria, who, incidentally, does not get absorbed into rabbinic Judaism. He ends up becoming, as we've seen in the podcast, a kind of honorary Christian, and the rabbis have no use for him at all. As we know from all these sources, there were three named groupings of Jews around in Palestine at the time of the temple's destruction: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. In the New Testament, we get the first two groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, without the Essenes. But the Essenes in Josephus are precisely the ultra-pious Jews who separate themselves from the larger Jewish milieu, do ascetic practices and lots of kind of pious exercises. And perhaps they go off into the wilderness to found intentional communities. And maybe that's what the Qumran Jews responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls were, regardless of how the endless arguments about whether the Qumran Jews were the Essenes mentioned by Josephus, or an offshoot of the Essenes, or something else might have been the case. The point is, in the mainstream, we have two known groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they have distinct beliefs. So Essenes, thank you, but you can go. One thing all of our sources agree on is that the Pharisees believe in an afterlife of some kind, while the Sadducees do not. The Pharisees also seem to have held various other beliefs which accord well with exposure to the apocalyptic literature, such as hopes in a coming redeemer figure, the messianism, while the Sadducees seem to have been much more focused on a small canon of texts, specifically the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, and they rejected the canonicity even of later parts of what's now known as the Hebrew Bible, the works of the prophets and the writings, to say nothing of the concept of oral law, which we'll come back to anon. Now, all of these Pharisaic beliefs are normative among rabbinic Jews, while the Sadducean positions are rejected. So, among modern scholars, no one can agree on the exact origins of these sects within Judaism, nor on how normative Pharisaic and Sadducean Judaism were, though it is a safe bet that the Essene-type ascetics were always a smallish minority. But everyone that I have read agrees that by some process which we don't fully understand, the Jews known as the Pharisees in Josephus and the New Testament gave rise to, in the post-temple period, a group of pious Jewish practitioners known in the rabbinic tradition itself as the sages and the rabbis. So the rabbis are thus the exceptionally pious specialist remnants of Pharisaic Second Temple Judaism. Now, there are scholars who disagree with this Pharisaic origins theory, I am told, but it does seem to be something approaching a consensus in the study of early rabbinic Judaism. Again, how many of these proto-rabbinic sages there were in the first centuries CE is debated, with estimates ranging from maximalist arguments. Rabbinic Judaism was soon, if not immediately, something like the new normal for most Jews after the temple's destruction, to more minimalist assessments like, for example, that of Schwartz, who suggests, quote, a small professional group of some sort, end of quote. So the rabbis were either like the new wave of Judaism that just kind of took hold and became the norm straight away, or they were a very small, like highly trained elite who would eventually evolve into the authoritative kind of voice for the next form of widespread Judaism. Now, the rabbinic tradition itself traces its lineage back to a whole series of Greco-Roman Jewish sages, which extends into the first century BCE before the temple was destroyed. Actually, it extends back to Moses, but we'll get to that. But rabbinic tradition associates a major turning point in this story of transformation of Judaism into rabbinic Judaism with a famous center of Jewish elders at a town called Yavne, under the leadership of Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai, and then his successor, Rabban Gamaliel II. And the result of Yavne, or let's say the social and religious changes which occurred in Palestinian Jewry after the destruction of the temple, and symbolized in the rabbinic literature by the conclave at Yavne, were a few things. First of all, pious, learned men, rabbis, teachers, sages, would become over time more and more central as the locus of community organization for Jews. So the synagogue community or congregation, headed by its rabbi, which is very familiar nowadays, this begins slowly and surely to evolve into a kind of congregational Judaism, centered around a learned authority figure rather than primarily sacrificial worship based in a temple or temples, you know, officiated by priests. So note that both in its Second Temple form and in its rabbinic form, Judaism was simply evolving roughly in line with other Mediterranean religious movements. Everyone in the old days used to sacrifice publicly in temples as the basic form of cult. And in late antiquity, there was a strong movement away from sacrifice and towards the more private congregation or even the lone religious specialist. In this sense, rabbinic Judaism is of a piece with Christianity, even Mithraism, new religious movements of the first centuries of our era, and Manichaeism, although it's unique in its religious caste system of regular Manichees and perfected ascetics, was also part of the broad move toward congregational worship centered around holy people rather than holy places. The first synagogues appear in our archaeological record from roughly the year 300, and by maybe 500, there has been a widespread congregationalization among Near Eastern Jews. Very imprecise dating, but our evidence is imprecise, and arguments really rage about this. Like, how soon do people start going to synagogues? The evidence, people used to say kind of straight away after the fall of the temple, maybe even before the fall of the temple. Now, as far as I can tell, the consensus is moving later and later, at least in terms of widespread synagoguery. Meanwhile, and here comes the textual revolution of late antiquity, our second main point for understanding rabbinic Judaism, vis-a-vis Western esotericism, groups of these highly erudite and very pious Jews, the sages, notably in Palestine and in the late Parthian and then Sasanian region of Babylon. So in other words, the main centers of Jewish kind of rabbinic sagery are southern, what's now southern Iraq and what's now Palestine. They get together in the first 2 centuries CE and begin to compile oral traditions of conversations, debates, or just pronouncements of various sages. A lot of it related to halakha or matters of Jewish law, but also other things which get grouped together under the catch-all category of Agadah. So these Jewish scribe scholars, traditionally known as the Tanaim, eventually will write this oral hermeneutical tradition down over the course of about 5 generations in the first 2 centuries of our era. And the written record of this 200 years of plus of activity is known as the Mishnah. This curious hybrid oral stroke written document has the status of a kind of scripture in rabbinic Judaism. So Mishnah is really key. Around the beginning of the 3rd century, we have the Mishnah. There's another document known as the Tosefta, which is from a similar milieu and deals with similar matters to the Mishnah, but it's not the same as the Mishnah. It's a kind of like sub-Mishnah or something. Once this had occurred, the Mishnah has been kind of made into a written, stable, non-oral format, the Talmuds begin to be written. Massive, truly massive bodies of recorded sayings of the rabbis, comprising commentary on the Mishnah, also containing much else dealing with Jewish life and law, bringing in hermeneutics of the Tanakh as well, of the sort of biblical scriptures, but structured as line-by-line commentary on the Mishnah. The Talmuds were eventually collected into gigantic bodies of commentary on commentary on commentary. The older Talmudic compilation is called the Jerusalem Talmud or Talmud Yerushalmi. It was compiled perhaps by the 4th century in Galilee. The larger Babylonian Talmud, and this one is usually what people mean if they just say the Talmud, was probably largely compiled by about the year 500, but by the nature of this document, glosses and interpretations continue to be added afterwards, such that if we really want to nail down its dates of completion, we need to say something like the Babylonian Talmud was completed sometime between the 6th and the 8th centuries. Now that's a long period, and this sort of open-ended date of completion brings us to a third development typical of what would become Rabbinic Judaism. And this one is one of the most fundamental importance for Western esotericism. So we have our first development, which is the sort of decentralized congregational move. The second is this huge body of texts, which have been brought in as in a sort of canonical status. And the third is the rabbinic notion of oral Torah. The oral Torah is a very complex notion indeed, but the crucial point to emphasize here is twofold. First of all, we have, with the proliferation of the oral traditions about the sages, transmitted and written down over centuries, an expansion of what rabbinic Jews will consider authoritative teaching. Texts like the Mishnah and the Babylonian Talmud, in these texts, rabbis make declarations on all sorts of matters, but most importantly on matters of halacha, or law. These pronouncements are authoritative, canonical Torah for rabbinic Jews. But when they contradict each other, when this rabbi says one thing and this rabbi says another thing, as they so often do, well, then the activity of halachic hermeneutics comes in. We must argue, we must weigh the comparative merits of this or that rabbi's pronouncement, and so forth. So there is a certain openness about the exact parameters of oral Torah among rabbinic Jews. And nothing could be more rabbinic than arguments about matters of Torah. It's the religion's trademark move. Now, certain other Jews, like the Karaites, a pretty small group today, deny the validity of the whole notion of oral Torah altogether. But the point for our purposes is that with the addition of to the canon of this oral element, the boundaries, as it were, of the canon come to lie not unambiguously on the pages of a Torah scroll containing the Tanakh. And we can plausibly say that for many Second Temple Jews, the Torah scroll containing the Tanakh had indeed been the extent of the literary canon of sacred texts. In fact, for the Sadducees, we know that it wasn't even the whole Tanakh, which was considered sacred, but just the five books of Moses. This authority now lies also in the Mishnah, in the Tosefta, in the Talmuds. And while the rabbinic move is to locate authority in these textual sources, right? The textual sources themselves are records of oral debates and opinions given by the sages over hundreds of years. And so the act of doing hermeneutics about this canon is in some ways overlapping or shading off from the canon itself, is in a sense a continuation of the oral Torah, or its living manifestation in the discussions of this huge body of texts among living rabbis. The quintessential rabbinic act of piety is study of Torah. The corpus of Torah has exploded from something arguably reasonably small and with roots going back to the Bronze Age into something gigantic with its roots in oral traditions, especially flowering into late antiquity. And this becomes a much bigger and much more sort of hard to draw hard lines around textual oral body of Torah. Now this opens a window for intriguing esoteric speculations to enter into Judaism, right? Among other things. And this brings us to our second main point about the Oral Torah. This is where Western esotericism must take strict notice here. There is a tradition that when God revealed the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, there was the revelation that got written down. That's the entire Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, which is what many Jews will mean by Torah if they're referring to Torah in this very narrow sense. But there was another revelation, an oral revelation to Moses, which wasn't written down. Different groups of Jews will consider the precise content of this oral revelation to have been different. But the point is that this oral revelation existed, and it's what has been handed down to the sages. And once the sages' pronouncements got written down in the Mishnah and the Talmud, the oral law had become sort of also written law, but it's still considered the oral Torah, right? The famous tractate Avot in the Mishnah makes the chain of transmission here official. Quoting the English translation from the Encyclopedia Judaica article on Avot, we read in Avot 1:1, quote, Moses received the Torah from Sinai and passed it on to Joshua, Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets passed it on to the men of the great assembly. End of quote. What follows this is a series of detailed sages who received the Torah all the way down to Mishnaic times, often interspersed with things each sage said. Now, what is being passed down here? And the word for passed down is Kabbalah, which the medieval movement known as Kabbalah would make much of, spoiler alert. What is being passed down here is not in the text, quote, the Oral Torah. The Oral Torah, as such, is a concept which isn't formulated in the Mishnah. It's formulated in the Talmud. What's being passed on, as far as the Mishnah is concerned, is just the Torah. But the Talmuds read this passing down of Torah as a double transmission, the written Torah of the five books of Moses and the Oral Torah, a revelation to Moses from God, which was only to be written down in this sort of open-ended process, precisely in the extended canon of Mishnah, Tosefta, Talmud. And while for many rabbinic Jews, that's the end of it, and you can say, okay, if it's not in these texts, it's not Oral Torah, well, there's a certain open-endedness there, which will be exploited by esoteric movements within rabbinic Judaism going forward. Now, the chain of transmission outlined in Avot is not esoteric as presented by the Mishnah and indeed by the Talmuds, although it is elite. What is being passed down, it's understood, is the Torah, be that understood by, as the Pentateuch or Jewish law as embodied in the sayings of the sages which make up the Mishnah. However, most importantly for the history of Western esotericism, this oral component of the transmission can be read as an esoteric transmission of knowledge. And this is how medieval Jewish esotericism will come to read the tractate Avot and, more generally, the Talmudic references to Oral Torah. The mere idea of an Oral Torah means that the door is open not only to a living hermeneutical flow in the way Jewish law is interpreted and lived, but also to really strange, wonderful, esoteric ideas, and even new, strange, and wonderful esoteric texts. The classic example here is the Zohar, arguably the most important work of the esoteric medieval Jewish tradition known as Kabbalah, written in the 13th century in Spain by one Moshe de Leon, but attributed to the Mishnaic sage Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, a second century student of Rabbi Akiva. Well, the Zohar, as the work of Shimon bar Yochai, is part of the Oral Torah to those who accept its authorial attribution. And the Zohar is an endless wellspring of a very different idea of elite Jewish spirituality than we find in the Mishnah, one which places experiential participatory metaphysics at the heart of the activity of the Kabbalist sage. And in fact, one which kind of folds the Sefer Yetzirah into the Oral Torah and a bunch of other interesting developments, which we shall get to in due course in the podcast. So what has happened between the destruction of the temple and, say, the end of the 5th century among the Jews? To sum up, we have these sort of academies of rabbis, trained teachers and expounders of Jewish scripture and law. They are very gradually coming to the forefront of the new Jewish way of life, eventually replacing the old temple priest hierarchy as a primary source of religious authority for Jews. Groups of these rabbis over generations compile a massive scriptural and parascriptural canon, which covers law of every sort, but also engages with theology in creative and complex ways, and opens doors for all kinds of speculation, which might be called mystical. And then later generations of these same sorts of specialists proceed to study and interpret this already massive body of text, and then add their own interpretations to it. The closing, as it were, of the canon, my sources among Orthodox Jewry tell me the canon is definitely closed, the Talmud is done. Nevertheless, the closure of it is a very difficult thing to pin down, and I find, at least myself, really attractive the idea that the canon cannot be closed because it is somehow alive every time rabbis get together and have a good old argument about halakhic matters, which is happening all the time. And this remains roughly the pattern which has survived until today in traditional Jewish communities. The rabbi, if he is to be a good rabbi, will have spent years studying this massive body of lore, the earliest layer of which is the books of Moses, the books of the prophets, the writings, and so on, but which reaches all the way from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age and into the Mishnah, written after the fall of the temple, and finally into the Talmuds, which codify the lore of influential groups of late antique rabbis, many of whom, like Rabbi Akiva, played important roles in anti-Roman struggles and so on into late antiquity. And this actually brings us right up to the modern day. For Orthodox Jews of all flavors, from pious Hasidim to hardly observant Jews, the rabbi is meant to know all of this traditional material inside and out. And then when you ask him, or nowadays ask her in some cases, a question regarding some matter of everyday life, which was totally unknown to the late antique Jewish sages who compiled the Talmuds, say you want to know if it's permissible to use a mobile phone on the Sabbath, he, or sometimes she, will be able to answer that question by bringing up a bunch of different points of jurisprudence from the Talmud and the Mishnah and so forth, and come to a ruling. Now, a different rabbi might give a different ruling on the same question. The consensus is never perfect, and it's not meant to be. Judaism never went down the ecumenical council route that Christianity did. So in fact, the idea of an Orthodox Jew, in quotes, is a very recent idea, the product of a kind of emulation of Christianity, which is pretty foreign to the majority of Jewish history. Rabbinic Judaism, like Islam later, is much better, in my view, considered in terms of an orthopraxis rather than an orthodoxy. Now, I don't mean to give the impression that Jews just have rituals and that there are no Jewish beliefs. This would be wrong. Rather, I'm trying to emphasize the degree to which, since the early Middle Ages, Judaism has been conceived of as something one belongs to and something one does, rather than something one believes in, right? So that is a very brief recap of some key developments in Judaism, which brings us into the rabbinic period and eventually down to the present day, where we shall be dwelling for a long stretch of this podcast. It's oversimplified. It's not the whole picture by any stretch, but I hope at least that it isn't actively wrong as far as it goes, and that it gives some context for all the esoteric things that are going to happen within rabbinic Judaism, which are all playing out against this background, right? This is the container, the exoteric container for the esoteric Jewish movements we shall be discussing. Now, what about those Christians and their ecumenical councils? Well, it's back to imperial politics. The Jews, while they were, as we say, a semi-protected tradition within the Roman world, never entered into Roman politics except when Romans decided a particular group of Jewish rebels had to be exterminated, and the Romans were notoriously fair. They exterminated populations perceived as foreign on a strictly equal basis. Christians, on the other hand, really were seen as a pernicious, antisocial enemy within by many Romans, were persecuted as such from time to time, though never with the sustained levels of martyrdom which the Christian martyr literature would have you believe. But then they took over the empire. In fact, in the year Iamblichus probably died, 325 CE, the Council of Nicaea took place, and Christianity was well on its way to being the official, supposedly universal, imperial religious creed. What the hell is going on there? How is that even possible in real life? Well, next time, in part two of this episode, we shall survey and discuss some crucial background which might help us answer the really, really interesting but totally insoluble question, how on earth did that happen? How and why did a fringe Jewish movement of the late Second Temple grow to become an imperial religion of a completely new stamp, unlike anything the world had ever seen before, and in the process, somehow deny its Jewish origins so completely as to become the world's first anti-Jewish religion? Join us then, and in the meantime, avoid any and all persecutions, pogroms, and centralized programs of ideologically motivated thought control by staying esoteric.